American chanteuse Linda Ronstadt, and You're No Good, and regrettably, her voice has been silenced by Parkinson's. However, through the miracle of modern technology, her beautiful voice has been preserved on vinyl, or CD, or MP3. Choose your medium. We will get back to our conversation with Gerald Posner, God's Bankers, A History of Money and Power at the Vatican. And it's certainly not my intention for this to sound like a hatchet job on Catholicism. Again, this is nothing to do with faith in Christ or the wonderful works that the Catholic Church does. In fact, according to one article, it was in The Economist, going back to about 2013, by some estimates, the Catholic Church in America alone spends something on the order of $4.7 billion on charities. Much of that, of course, health care, funding hospitals and so forth, schools, their work inside parishes and dioceses, colleges and universities account for something like $48 billion over the years. So, again, the Catholic Church doing a great deal of good. However, God's Bankers is filled with political intrigue, mystery, suspense. It's a bit of a thriller, and also, as chapter one would suggest, a bit of a murder mystery. More of my conversation with Gerald Posner, as I say, coming up, and your calls at the bottom of this hour. Stay with us here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Richard Serrett with you, and Gerald Posner as well, as we talk about the rise of the Vatican Bank. Give us a sense of the scope, magnitude, influence of the Vatican Bank. For example, how would it compare in assets to, say, Goldman Sachs?
It'd be much smaller. As a matter of fact, Richard, it's only like a mid-sized sort of a bank in the U.S., mid-sized community bank. It's dealing with, we now know from the first balance sheets that have been shown in the last few years, between $8 and $10 billion a year. So small in terms of Wall Street size, but significant in terms of Vatican size, especially when you consider that all that money's flowing through, much of it in cash, because remember, they are only representing religious institutions and priests, and the religious institutions and orders are taking a lot of donations in terms of cash, so it's coming in that way. And you're also dealing with a country, in terms of the Vatican, that had no law against money laundering until 2011, had no law against the financing of terrorism until 2011, had no limit on the amount of money that could be brought in as cash into through the border, be like $10,000 or 10,000 euros, until they passed it in 2012. And that's only because the Europeans pushed them, because they're now using the euro. But before that, no regulations at all. They accepted physical deposits, which meant truckloads, literally, of gold after World War II, as I talk about, that arrived at the doorstep of the Vatican, and then the gold disappears, and we're talking about what happened to it. And, you know, before, you were mentioning in the break the extent to which the Vatican does so much in terms of charity, the Catholic Church, and they do. I mentioned in the book that they're the largest charities in the world, and at the same time, because sometimes Catholics will say to me who haven't read the book, oh, it's anti-Catholic. And Catholics who have read the book say, whoa, I didn't know this at all. I'm really glad I read it. And that's because it's not anti-Catholic. It's a history. And like any history, it has low points and high points. And there are, unfortunately, a lot of low points in this history, but they're there for people to learn from. And we were talking before about the formation of the Vatican Bank. You know, we went over in 1935, there was a war in Ethiopia that Mussolini launched. The Vatican sort of exhorted Italians to join it and made money off the munitions. They were invested in the munitions companies that were involved in the war from Nagorno putting them in. In 1933, going back a couple of years earlier, the Vatican was the first country in the world to recognize Hitler. Hitler had had no country recognize him as the Chancellor of Germany, as the new government being legitimate, until the Church did. They hit a deal with him, and as part of that deal, the Church collects a tax in Germany, which they still do, which is voluntary. It used to be voluntary, 8 to 10% of your income. Hitler agreed to collect that at the source, like a payroll tax, and pay it to the Vatican. In the middle of World War II, it was bringing in $100 million a year. The Vatican was incredibly big to their budget. So, you know, we forget about that. And then, as I said, they formed the Vatican Bank. And the reason why? Because the Americans and British have a so-called blacklist in which they're looking to stop countries from doing business with the Nazis. They put every country in Europe on the blacklist, including Monaco, San Marino, Liechtenstein, Andorra, Switzerland. The only country that wasn't put on by 1942 was the Vatican. They were left off because it was the only sovereign European country that did not have its own banking system. And then what does the Vatican do? In June of 42, they form the banking system. They create the Vatican Bank. That allows them to go dark. And from that point on, they're doing business in the black. The U.S. cannot see them. They're trading money back and forth. We only know it after the war with Germany. And as I disclose in this book, for the first time, they invest in, through Italian proxies, in Italian and German insurance companies, including the biggest ones like Allianz and Generali. And in 1943 and 44, those companies start to cheat the life insurance policies of Jews being sent to Auschwitz. They know they're going, and they say, you know, there's a cash value to these policies. They take them off the books, and it increases their profits, outsized profits. And the Vatican, through its investments, earns the benefit of that. Did the Pope know about it? I'm sure not, because they didn't want to know. All they wanted to know is that the Vatican Bank was making money, and it came out of the gate roaring with money.
You mentioned World War II, Hitler. Interesting. I mean, the Third Reich rolled over France, rolled through Poland, and yet they did not invade the Vatican. Why not?
You know, it's a great question. The Vatican was afraid of that all the time. They were afraid that Hitler was going to turn against them and keep the tax money, which was one of the things. They thought that he might come in and take over Vatican City and take the Pope back a prisoner to Germany. 70% of the top Nazis were, in fact, Catholics, although many of them Catholics in name only. The rest were Lutheran. The Pope thought that he might be able to bring them back to some form of Catholicism at some point. He feared, he had been a nuncio to Germany, an ambassador to Germany before he became Pope. He spoke German fluently, all his aides were German, he liked things German. He thought he might be able to convince even Hitler and the top Nazis to soften their position against the church. And he feared communism, the Reds, the Bolsheviks, and Stalin much more, because he knew they were equal opportunity atheists. They were closing up churches and synagogues, moving against the Orthodox faith, the Christian Orthodox faith, and everybody at once. So while he thought there might be a possibility of moderating Hitler, he knew there was no possibility of doing that with Stalin. So it shoved him closer to the Nazis. And even when Mussolini fell and the Germans took over Rome in 1943, they didn't move against the Vatican. As a matter of fact, they rounded up the Jews of Rome for the first time because Mussolini had been slow and reluctant to do that. They marched them within eyesight of the Pope's window, and the Pope made no protest at all. They shipped them out to Auschwitz. So the relationship with the Vatican and the Third Reich was strained at times. The Pope didn't speak out strongly against the Third Reich time and time again, and I discussed that in a long chapter about why he didn't, but some of it was clearly financial, and I set that out in this book for the first time.
To what extent does or did the Pope oversee the day-to-day operation of the Vatican Bank? Would he receive a daily or a weekly briefing, for example?
Right. Absolutely critical. Here's the Pope. He's the only shareholder of the Vatican Bank. So is it the type of thing where you're the titular shareholder and you don't do anything and it's run down at a minion level? One of the things to remember, as opposed to the U.S. government or what people think of as governments at all, that because it's only 700 to 800 people in Vatican City, it's much smaller, and it depends on the style of the Pope. So some popes have a removed style in terms of finances. The Polish Pope, some people may remember John Paul II. He wasn't into finances at all. He wasn't into finances when he was the Cardinal of Krakow, and he wasn't that concerned about finances when he came into Vatican City. The German Pope, who just resigned, the last one, Benedict, before Francis, not concerned about finances. But Pius XII, the wartime Pope, who was Pope from 1939 to 1958, he was into finances, but more than that, He, Richard, was a micromanaging pope. He was a guy into the details. When telexes would come in from his different ambassadors around the world, they normally would go over to the Secretary of State's office in the Vatican. They would instead go to him as well as a copy. He would answer them personally. He knew what was going on in a different way. He met with the head of the Vatican Bank once a week. He got those reports and update. And so in terms of Pius, I would say that he's probably the most involved pope in terms of the money and finances.
Let's circle back to Roberto Calvi. Let's see if we can sort of, you know, bring that to a conclusion as best you can. What did Calvi's, perhaps his murder, have to do with the Vatican Bank? I mean, he was involved in the Vatican Bank. He had close ties with the Vatican Bank. But what is your research, where has it led you in terms of motivation or the motive for his death?
Well, Calvi was one of the most prominent bankers in Italy and was involved with the Vatican Bank, with the American archbishop who was running the bank, a fellow called Paul Marcinkus, in a whole host of illegal activity, which I detail for pages, these hundreds of millions of dollars in fake back-to-back loans in which the church would earn money from those, questionable deposits that came from people that were laundering money or trying to avoid taxes at the very least. And Marcinkus was actually on these offshore banks as a director together with Calvi. They got in over their head, and at one point near the end when the whole thing starts to unravel, Calvi goes to Marcinkus at the Vatican Bank for more money. He needs yet more to bail him out because the entire thing's about to fall down. He's over $1 billion in debt with all of these fake ghost companies, and no one quite knows that there's no money behind the paper tiger. And Marcinkus doesn't give him any more money, but at this point he gives him two letters that essentially says, we, the Vatican, stand behind most of these ghost companies and we'll back them up. Calvi goes out and then tries to raise more money with that. Those letters are fake because the Vatican Bank made Calvi give him a letter back secretly at the same time that said, by the way, I know that these letters that you've given me of patronage and support really don't mean anything, and you really won't give me any money at all. So the Vatican was involved in what was an extensive fraud, so much so, Richard, that when Calvi ends up dead, what happens? The Italian prosecutors indict Marcinkus, head of the Vatican Bank and archbishop, and his two top lay assistants, trying to get to him for a whole host of felonies and white-collar crimes, and the Vatican says, no way, you can't touch him because we're a sovereign country. And those three men stay inside Vatican City. The Italians go all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court eventually rules you cannot extradite somebody who's a citizen of Vatican City out of the Vatican to stand trial in Italy for crimes committed in Italy. It was a shocking decision, and it protected them and protected the Vatican Bank. And you have to remember just one quick footnote to this. Not only did Calvi end up dead, but the man who did business with the Vatican Bank beforehand, that some of your listeners may remember, Michele Sindona, was one of the biggest titans in all of Italy, who had been the Vatican Bank's original businessman of sorts, was the one who not only ended up breaking the law repeatedly and ended up in jail, but when he's in jail for the second day after being convicted in Italy of having killed the prosecutor, and he was called God's banker because he was so close to the Pope at the time in the 60s and the 70s, he ends up all of a sudden grabbing at his throat. They have him in a special wing of the jail they've built for him because they're afraid somebody may try to kill him. And they have his food monitored. It's prepared in a separate part of the kitchen, and then it's taken with a sealed lid down to his jail cell where he is monitored 24 hours a day by three different shifts of guards and a television camera. And then they take the lid off the food, and he's able to have the food. He has his meal on the second day, grabs at his throat, and he says, I can't breathe, I can't breathe. I've been poisoned. He keels over. It turns out to be cyanide poisoning, and the Italian court look into it, and they say, suicide. So that happens to the first guy who deals with the Vatican Bank, and then Calvi ends up under a bridge hanging from a rope around his neck, and they say, suicide. You know, something doesn't start to add up here after a while.
And we should mention that Calvi had his pockets were filled with rocks, and you know, after if he had in fact climbed up that scaffolding on Blackfriars Bridge, they would have found you know, rust stains and so forth under his fingernails or on his clothing. None of that. So as you say, very, very suspicious. Well, connections between Kelvey and the infamous P2 Masonic Lodge. What is that all about?
Yeah, I mean, P2 is absolutely something, you know. Sometimes I know before your first guest had said that he liked fiction because you can do things in fiction you can't do in nonfiction. It gives you a different thing. But I must say that even the best novelist would have trouble coming up with P2 and believing that it really could be real, because P2 is a secret organization, Freemasons, which the Vatican, by the way, has always been against. Remember, the Vatican doesn't like Freemasons. They fought them. They viewed them as dangerous, and they try to stamp them out. So in Italy, because the Pope said being a Freemason was not allowed, they were essentially illegal. So there's a secret Freemason organization called Propaganda Due, and shorthand is P2 for it, and it forms in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. By the 60s, when it really comes into its heyday, it is about 1,500 people that really is a state within a state. Its members include everybody from four sort of cabinet ministers, about 50 generals, admirals, some of Italy's most important industrialists, financiers, public prosecutors, judges, journalists, even intelligence operatives. That membership roster was stunned Italy so much that when they moved against it to try to take it out, it wasn't just an exclusive club. It was sort of the people who could run the country in many ways. And as a result of that, Calvi was a member. Sindona, who I mentioned a second ago, who died of cyanide poisoning in his jail cell and did business with the Vatican Bank, was a member of it. And there were rumors that Marcinkus, the archbishop who ran the Vatican Bank, was a member. But when they found the membership rolls, Marcinkus's name was not on, and he always denied that. But there's no question that the men around Calvi and around Sindona, as well as them, the ones who were transferring the money for the Vatican Bank, the guy called Gelli, who ran the P2, were all close to the Pope, all involved in the Vatican Bank, and all making a lot of money off of it.
Has the Vatican Bank ever been audited, or has anyone ever attempted to audit the Vatican Bank?
Yeah, well, yes, it's had an audit of sorts in the last few years. There's been two audits. Here's where the story is changing, and this is why I say that this book ends on a positive note or on a hopeful note for all Catholics who otherwise sort of get nervous that this is just too bad of a history. The positive note that it ends on is things are changing, and I think that these, I live in Miami, so for me, when I talk about the craziest possible days of something that was bad, I talk about the cocaine cowboy days, as they were here in Miami in the 80s. The cocaine cowboy days of the Vatican Bank may be over, and going forward, it may become just a boring, mundane bank that has an occasional scandal and financial problems here and there, but on the whole isn't involved in what I call making profits off of the Holocaust or involved with mobsters, and as it was in the 80s and 90s, are becoming a place for slush funds for at least top politicians. The reason for that is, you said, is it audited? It used to be in the dark to everybody, including other parts of the Vatican. And then what changed it was that in 1999, Italy decided that it was going to adopt the euro, and it gave up the lira. The Vatican used the lira for its own currency, so they had to decide what they were going to do. Were they going to publish and print their own money, or were they going to go ahead and use the common currency in Europe? And they had this debate about it. They decided to go with the euro, but what they didn't realize at that time, Richard, was that by going with the euro, they would be subject to evaluation by Brussels and the European Union to see whether their central bank was compliant with international banking rules and regulations, because they have this sort of scale that they look at. You can be an F, in which case you're completely an outlaw bank. You can be an A, in which case you're compliant, you're doing everything right. And the Vatican had all of a sudden start to make sure that it could pass the first inspection from what's called MoneyVal, these European inspectors. That's why earlier we talked about the first law against the financing of terrorism. 2011, they're cleaning up their act. First law against money laundering, 2011, they're cleaning up their act. They've closed more than 3,000 accounts in the last few years. Those were accounts that belonged to everyone from mobsters to people who should never have had them, to wealthy Italians who were not paying taxes and putting their money in this bank as though it was an offshore bank in the heart of Rome. So the fact that the Europeans have come in to look at the bank and they grade them a C, they've given the whole list of things they still have to improve. They're not an F, but they're not on the white list yet. means that the Vatican is cleaning up its act. It has no choice to, or it would have to stop using the euro.
All right, Gerald Posner, stay where you are. We will open up the phone lines, take questions and comments, talking about God's bankers and the history of the Vatican Bank. I'd love to change the world 10 years after, taking us into the break. My name is Richard Serrett. You're listening to Coast AM. And this is Ram Jam and Black Betty, American hard rock band formed in New York back in 1977. And this was their big hit single, Black Betty, from 1977. It's a good one. If you're listening to Coast right now, maybe you're alone and you're wondering, is there someone out there for me, someone to spend your days and your nights with, someone to share Coast Coast with? The answer is yes. And ParanormalDate.com could make that happen. The more members at ParanormalDate.com, the better, because if we increase the size of the pool of members, it makes it more likely you'll find that someone special. And all we need is 270 new members to push ParanormalDate.com over the 15,000 mark. Why not become a member tonight? ParanormalDate.com. It's now available in Canada. Officially known as the Institute for Religious Works, the Vatican Bank plays an essential role in helping facilitate the Vatican's role in confronting poverty worldwide, but it's also been connected with widespread corruption and money laundering. We'll get back to our conversation with Gerald Posner, author of God's Bankers, A History of Money and Power at the Vatican. You're listening to Coast AM. My name is Richard Serrett. Hang in there. And we are back with Gerald Posner, author of God's Bankers, A History of Money and Power at the Vatican. Gerald, before we dip into the calls, and we have a full board, not surprisingly, let me ask you about the sudden death of Pope John Paul I back in 1978, 33 days after his election, relatively young man, 65, in good health by all accounts. Official cause of death was natural causes. Any connection there with the Vatican Bank? Was he, for example, trying to reform the Vatican Bank?
Yeah, he was, in the sense that he was known not to be a friend of Bishop Marcinkus, who was running the Vatican Bank, who already had some problems. And a lot of people thought that when this pope came in, that he would sweep Marcinkus aside, in part for money, because years earlier, Marcinkus had pushed through the right for Calvi, who ended up dead in London, to buy a bank in Venice. It was a Catholic bank, and it was sort of the gem of Catholic banks in Venice, which is where this pope came from. He was the cardinal there. He didn't like it. He went back to Marcinkus to argue against the sale. Marcinkus dismissed him very abruptly. So when he becomes the pope years later, people think that's the end of Marcinkus. And then 33 days later, as you said, he's dead. So it looks suspicious. I looked into that as much as I could. Of course, Richard, in the end, you can never determine it with 100% because of the fact that there was no autopsy done and the pope was buried. But what I did determine is that I think he died of natural causes, but there were many people who wanted him dead and they celebrated his death. But more than that, the Vatican had a cover-up after the death, which is why so many people think it was a murder. The cover-up was not of a murder, but it was, in fact, for their own puritanical reasons. A nun had discovered him dead at 5:36 o'clock in the morning. She used to bring him his coffee every day. That was the routine. The Vatican thought that that would look terrible, that a woman, even if it was a nun, was the first person to find the pope in his bedroom that early in the morning, and that people would think it involved sex or some other thing. They lied about the book that he had. They didn't do the autopsy. They covered up a whole series of things. So when you see the cover-up, you think something suspicious, and it is, but when you realize what they're covering up, it's not in this case a murder, but there is no doubt that there were people who were glad that he had a very short papacy.
All right, let's go to the phones, and the first-time caller is John from Des Moines, Iowa. Good morning, John. Welcome to Coast.
Yes, Richard, you answered my question already. I wanted to know whether Pope John was killed because he wanted to reform the Vatican Bank.
All right. Well, sorry to steal your thunder, John. But maybe as a follow-up to that, Gerald, I mean, what did Pope John Paul I intend to do with the Vatican Bank?
Well, that was no one's really clear of. So, you know, I think what happens, Richard, is that when you have a very short period, and there's nothing shorter than 33 days, but even, you know, when you have a time when you're head of a country or head of an organization and you're only there for a short while, people tend to look back on that short period and they put into your tenure whatever they wanted and hoped that you would do. So, you know, if they think you were going to eliminate the Vatican Bank, they think he would have done that. If he was going to fire Marcinkus, he would have done that the next day. If he was going to approve contraception and allow abortion, he was going to do that. So they sort of put into him all of their hopes and expectations for reforms. I think he, based upon the way that he ran his parish, his diocese in Venice, he was not a hands-on micromanager when it came to finances, but he was, I think, very likely to get a new head of the Vatican Bank. That would have been about as much of the changes he was going to do. Look at, when I say to you that Francis, the current Pope, is a reformer, which he is, he's the real deal when it comes to the finances and Vatican Bank. Remember, he's being forced to in some ways. Anybody who's Pope today would have to do that if the Vatican wants to stay in the euro. If it had not been for that, I don't think any Pope would have really tackled the Vatican Bank with vigor or enthusiasm, because it's such a moneymaker for this small government that they talk about changing it. They always talk about changing it, but they wouldn't do it unless they had to.
The wild card line, Jeff is in Culver City. Jeff, good morning. Welcome to Coast.
Yeah, how you doing, Richard and Mr. Posner? Yeah, my mother once said of all religions who collect money from their congregations, if they're not doing any good with the money they collect, and they're doing something bad with it, surely God wants any money collected from believers to be used for the benefit of mankind. You know, imagine the public relations bonanza the Catholic Church would garner worldwide by actually spending a vast portion of that money in the Vatican Bank to help all of the refugees around the world, you know, regardless of their religious affiliation or beliefs. But my question is this, Mr. Posner, why doesn't the Catholic Church and the Vatican Bank use this money to actually help these refugees around the world? You know, and do you think that if they did that, you know, it would help with public relations, especially given all the sex and child abuse and, you know, perverted scandals they had swirling around the church? And take your answer.
Good, Jeff. Good question, Jeff. I think we made the point, Gerald, that they do use that money for good.
So here's you're right, Richard. So to Jeff's question, they do spend a lot of money, more than Catholic Charities, more than any other charities in the world in terms of spreading it out. But the refugee issue is a very interesting one, Jeff, because refugees are flooding into Europe. It's a problem that, you know, we see the migrants coming in from Syria and across from Tunisia and Algeria on boats, and, you know, they're risking their lives to get to Italy and to Greece and to other parts of southern Europe, and Europe's trying to figure out how to move the migrants around Europe and how to absorb all of this. The Pope believes that the migrants should have pretty open access to come in, and some churches in Germany in that have given safe haven status to migrants. If you can reach a church, they'll consider you safe, and they'll put you up with room and board until the country decides to keep you there. So the question is, how much is the Catholic Church going to spend on migrants? How much is it going to spend on refugees? That's an open question. We still need to see that. We're talking tens of millions of dollars that have to be spent here at some point. And I do think that this is a pope, because Jeff mentioned in his question, Richard, public relations. This is a pope who understands public relations. He's a populist. He knows what a good soundbite is, better than some popes in the last, several decades. And he's trying to expand the popularity of the church, because in the end, the church is worried about numbers, meaning the numbers of people that it has. It wants more and more numbers. Every church wants that. And they're losing numbers and worshipers in Central and South America. He's a South American from Argentina, to evangelicals, who are convincing people that the Catholic Church has lost its way, that it's just a corrupt institution, and the real faith in Jesus to be found in these evangelical offshoots. And so as a result, the Pope is fighting back, and they are trying to use the public relations to make themselves once and again the one true Christian church. It will take a long time to do that, but they're making that effort.
To the international line we go. Terry is in Vancouver. Terry, good morning. Welcome to Coast.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I'd like to ask Mr. Posner if the Catholic Church is invested in munitions or arms at all.
Yes, Terry, that's a great question, because one of the things that happens in this book, and I talk about it, is that there's a period in which the Catholic Church, through the Vatican Bank, is invested in companies in Italy. And what happens in the 1960s is, to their great embarrassment, in 67 and 68, Italian reporters uncover the fact that the Vatican is invested in this company then called Istituto Farmacologico Serono, which is a pharmaceutical company that made birth control pills. So that was bad. They didn't like that at all. They were also invested in Udon, a military weapons manufacturer. They had some money in Beretta, a gun maker, a Monte Carlo casino, and a printing firm that published porn. So all of that sort of led them to divest themselves of those private company investments, and they got out of that business. But even back in the 30s, in the mid-30s, when Italy went into Ethiopia and they had the invasion that was a sort of a slaughter of colonial Ethiopia, the Vatican was invested at that time in munitions makers and were making money off the arms companies that helped fuel Mussolini's invasion. So they have been invested in arms companies before. They have been invested in companies that made birth control pills. They've tried to divest themselves of that today and do socially conscious investments, which really means they're investing in real estate, in property, although it turned out a year ago, to their embarrassment, a year and a half ago, it was discovered that they own the building that houses the largest gay bathhouse in Rome. They all sort of said, oh, we didn't know that. But of course, a couple of priests who work inside the Vatican, higher ranking priests, lived upstairs in the Vatican apartments in that building. So somehow they didn't notice what was happening on the first floor. But that happens time and time again to them.
Terry, thanks for the call. How does the bank work? Can I invest in the bank? Can I deposit money in the Vatican Bank?
No, that's the great thing. So, Richard, what happens is you can't just walk in and open an account. The only branch in the world happens to be in Vatican City. So there's no other branch and no other church, no other diocese or parish or anywhere else. So the only branch is physically in Vatican City. It's the only bank in the world, by the way, that has ATM machines that has Latin as one of the languages. True, as a little side point.
that's great.
The only people that can open up accounts are either citizens of Vatican City. And by the way, it's the only country in the world that owns more property outside of its physical country than the country itself. And it's the only country in the world in which its citizens constantly change. And what I mean by that is, if you go to work as an American priest to work in Vatican City, as long as you're there, whether you're a cardinal, a bishop, or whatever else, in Vatican City, you get the citizenship of Vatican City. If you return, you retire, you come back to America to a diocese here, you're no longer a citizen of Vatican City. You lose it when you leave the city itself. So the citizenship always changes. The number's about the same, but who is a citizen changes, so those people can open up accounts. Then religious orders can open up accounts. And this is the big loophole. What's been a loophole for the mafia in previous years, because they laundered money through there, a loophole for wealthy Italians, was this religious charities, the charities that could open up businesses or accounts there. So there were charities that were fakes. Nobody knew they were fakes. They would open up an account because you would find a compliant priest to open that account up for you, and then you would funnel cash in there, and it was safe, it wasn't taxed, and you didn't have to worry about it. So all you had to do was find a priest or a bishop who was willing to do it for you, pay them somehow, and they opened up that account, and you were up and running. And the thing that's so perplexing about it for investigators and DEA and tax agents and everything else is, because it's in Rome, you don't even have to do a wire transfer. When people wire transfer money into an offshore bank in the Singapore or Hong Kong or the Bahamas or Panama, they leave a wire trace that can be tracked by a government. Inside the Vatican Bank, you literally just have to go in with a suitcase of cash. You go across the street. Remember, there's no customs to go from Rome into the Vatican City, for those who haven't been there. If you're on a street corner in Rome, the light turns green, you cross the street, and the next thing you know, when you're on the other side of the street, you're in Vatican City. That's how it's seamless. So when you go across the street and you have cash with you, they accept physical deposits, you give it to the friendly priest who's helping you out by having created the charitable foundation. Like we talked about before, the president of Italy, the prime minister, had an account called the Francis Spellman Foundation. Some are called the Loreto Sisters, some the Little Sisters of Assisi. These were all fake accounts used in the 90s and into the 2000s by politicians in Italy. And the money is deposited and there's no trace of it even in a wire transfer. That's why I think the Vatican Bank for a while was the world's favorite offshore bank, especially for wealthy Italians.
And what would happen if the Vatican Bank were to become insolvent? Would the Catholic Church essentially be bankrupt?
Yeah, the Catholic Church would certainly be, the Vatican itself would be in a great deal of trouble. And as a matter of fact, this almost happened in the 80s when Marcinkus, the American Archbishop who was running it and doing business with Sindona, the businessman who ends up dead of cyanide in jail after his second day, and with Calvi, who ends up hanging under a London bridge. After those two, when the Italians indicted Marcinkus, but the Vatican wouldn't turn him over, the Vatican ended up paying $244 million, which for them was a lot of money at the time, in cash, to a group of banks as a settlement. Now, you'll love this, Richard. They paid it under an agreement that was hammered out for over a year for, quote, I'm not kidding you, moral considerations. They wouldn't say for wrongdoing or because we did anything wrong or we're involved in these criminal back-to-back loans. For moral considerations, they paid out $250 million. And when you said, would they go bankrupt? The sex abuse scandal, which I cover in only one chapter in this book, but I covered only from a financial perspective, shows you how wise the Catholic Church is when it comes to this. The Vatican, when the sex abuse cases started to break in Rome, they thought this was a peculiarly American phenomenon because they viewed Americans as very puritanical. They said, oh, this is only happening in America. Well, it was an international problem for them eventually, from Ireland to England to Australia. But at that time, they thought it was America only. They brought the lawyers in, and they made sure that every diocese was separate from every other diocese, legally separate entities, so that if one went down, it wouldn't bring down a neighboring diocese that was wealthy. And as a result, 11 dioceses in America have gone bankrupt since the sex abuse crises have broke because of the payments that they've had to make in settlements for pedophile priests. But those 11 that went bankrupt didn't affect any other diocese, and they didn't affect the Vatican because the Pope at the time, Benedict, the German Pope, was worried that some clever American lawyer would sue him, saying you are the ultimate employer of these pedophile priests. And that's exactly what happened. A number of American lawyers sued Benedict, saying you, the Pope, you're responsible. We want to get money from the Vatican as well. These bankrupt dioceses aren't good enough. We're going to come after you. And finally, after a number of court decisions, the American appellate courts ruled that the Pope cannot be sued in an American court over the sex abuse crisis because he is a sovereign of a foreign country. That's when the sovereign part came to the Vatican's benefit. So those suits were all dismissed against the Pope.
Gerald Posner, my guest, and we will continue to delve into the Vatican Bank, God's Bankers, A History of Money and Power at the Vatican. And we'll also continue to take questions and comments. If you have a line, hold on to it. We'll get to you after the break as we roll into that. But let me just throw this out there now. We can start to talk about it. You mentioned Pope Benedict, of course, an historical resignation. I'm not sure, but that may have been unprecedented. I don't know that a pope has ever resigned before. And I'm wondering whether that has anything to do with the Vatican Bank.
The short answer is yes. It was one of the things he was faced with three different issues. One was the Vatican Bank and scandals inside the bank that he was unable to quell. His head of the bank was dismissed over money laundering issues in 2012, and he wasn't quite sure how to handle that. The other part was that there was questions of sort of what I call a gay lobby inside the Vatican, and there was a report done by three cardinals to him, that there was the equivalent of a casting couch at some level inside the Vatican, and he wasn't sure what to do about that. And I think the last issue for Benedict was that he was the wrong person to be Pope at the wrong time. And as a result, there was a point in which he threw up his hands and said, I can't take it. He also had a leaks going on, Vatican leaks, in which his butler was leaking documents out that were embarrassing him and the rest of the Vatican. So for him, it was the perfect storm, and he just stepped aside.
All right, Gerald. Stay put, and we will reconnoiter on the other side. Pictures of Matchstick Men by Status Quo taking us into the break. Again, if you've got a line, hold on to it. We'll get to you. Coast to Coast AM, Richard Serrett.